Happy Friday to each and every one of you. I hope it's going to be a great weekend. Please make it even better by being with your brothers and sisters in Christ at your home congregation. If you don't have one, you need to go out and find one. And if you just happen to be living within the driving distance of the Elkhart East building, we invite you to come and see whether or not we might be a potential home congregation for you. Open to Numbers chapter 23, verse 13, where we are seeing the story of the greedy prophet Balaam, or Balaam. He starts out belonging to the true and living God. He is a very successful prophet of God Most High, the Creator God, the God of Israel, actually, but even though he did not realize it, I think, at the time. And he has been contacted by the king of Moab to come and curse Israel in the spirit realm, because the king of Moab thinks that if that happens, he might actually be able to beat the Israelis in the physical realm and kind of take control of his property that he lost to the Amorites a few years earlier. The first curse session didn't go so well, because instead of a curse, Balaam performs a blessing, because that's what God told him to perform. And so as we pick up the story in verse 13 of chapter 23 of Numbers, it says, Balak said to him, please come with me to another place from which you may see them, that is Israel. You're only going to see a fraction of them. You're not going to see them all. And then you curse them for me from there. And so he took him to the field of Zophim, to the top of Pisgah. Pisgah is the name of this mountainous range that is on the northeast corner of the Dead Sea Basin. And it overlooks the plains of Moab down on the north side of the Dead Sea. The plains of Moab, which are on the east side of the Jordan River across from Jericho. And so that's where Israel's encamped. And so he wants to take him to a different site, hoping that maybe the power of the Israeli God will be lessened from there, and the power of any gods that Balaam can invoke will be stronger there. Because remember, these folks function under the idea that all gods were localized. So he took him there and then built seven altars, and he offered a ram and a bull and a ram on each of them. So they're going to repeat the worship ceremony. The seven altars seem, I think, to represent the number of leaders that are present for this ceremony, although some people believe it's just the perfect number, the number of completion that is being symbolized here. And I'm okay with that as well as a possibility. So verse number 15, Balaam said to Balak, stand here beside your burnt offering while I meet he who is over there. Same thing as last time. And so he who is met with Balaam, put a word in his mouth and said, return to Balak, and thus shall you speak. So exactly the same formula as last time. So he came to him, and behold, he was standing beside his burnt offering and the princes of Moab with him. And Balak said to him, what has he who has spoken? So what's the message? What's the curse? And so Balaam offers his second prophetic utterance. Rise, Balak, and hear. Give ear to me, O son of Zippor. And once again, this takes on the form of Hebrew poetry, Middle Eastern poetry. You give one line, and then you turn around and make a second line that uses synonyms or synonymous phrasing. So you're doubling up on it. Verse 19. God is not man that he should lie, or a son of man that he should change his mind. So he's not human. He's not fickle. Has he said and will he not do it? Or has he spoken and will he not fulfill it? Now, what's really being intimated here is all about the Abrahamic blessing of God. Abraham was promised that God would be his God and that he would bless him and bless those who bless him and curse those who curse him, and that in his seed all the nations of the earth are going to be blessed. That blessing was passed on to Yitzhak. Then it was passed on to Jacob. Jacob gets a rename of Israel, and the 12 tribes are the recipients of that blessing from Abraham. And also now this group down there in the plains of Moab, they are the beneficiaries of all of that blessing from God. And so God's prophecy through Balaam is, I'm not going to go back on my blessing of Israel. Verse number 20. Behold, I received a command to bless. He is blessed, and I cannot revoke it. He has not beheld misfortune in Jacob, nor has he seen trouble in Israel. He who is their God is with them, and the shout of a king is among them. So Israel is not the ones that are going to get it in the neck. They're blessed, not cursed. In fact, they've got their king with them, and that's where they can shout. God brings them out of Egypt and is for them like the horns of the wild ox. Horns were symbolic of power and therefore of authority. And in this context here, God is the horn that is protecting Israel. I'm not a sports guy, but I understand there's like some people that are big sports fans of a group that has a bull as their symbol, and they'll even make a little sign with their fingers, you know, with their hands, with their index and their pinky finger sticking up, and they'll say, you mess with the bulls, you get the horns, right? Well, this is way before that about God. You mess with God's people and you get God's horns. Verse 23, for there is no enchantment against Jacob, no divination against Israel. So you can't do them in the spirit world through curses. It's just not going to happen. Now it shall be said of Jacob and Israel, oh, what has God wrought? That's an expression of amazement. Behold, a people. As a lioness, it rises up. As a lion, it lifts itself. It does not lie down until it's devoured the prey and drunk the blood of the slain. In the time period of the Old Testament, Israel was home to a whole bunch of big cats. And because of that, the people living there were impressed by the power and majesty of these lions. And so they were a symbol of great majesty and authority. And so here he compares, at God's direction, understand, Israel to a lion. And until the lion gets what it gets, it's not going to stop. And so this is an outright warning from God through Balaam to Balak, the king of Moab. Don't mess with Israel. If you mess with Israel, you're messing with God. And you will be the one that gets it in the neck. Now, how does Balak feel about that? Verse 25. Balak said to Balaam, "Do not curse them at all. Don't bless them at all." So basically, just shut up. If you can't curse them for me, definitely don't bless them. But Balaam answered Balak, "Did I not tell you all that he who is says that I must do?" So I told you, I warned you before all this started that this is the way it was going to go. Balak said to Balaam, "Come now, I'm going to take you to another place. Perhaps it will please God," and he uses that generic term for God. It's actually in a plural form, so gods, "that you may curse them for me from there." So once again, this idea, apparently that God of Israel must radiate a lot of power outward, and so he's got control of this site. And so I'm going to take you to another site where maybe he doesn't have as much influence, and maybe you can invoke the spirit world against them there. So Balak took Balaam to the top of Peor, which overlooks the desert. So it's another worship site for the gods and goddesses of the region. And Balaam said to Balak, "Go ahead and build for me 7 altars and prepare for me 7 bulls and 7 rams." So we're back to the same procedure again. And Balak did as Balaam had said and offered a bull and a ram on each altar. Chapter 24, when Balaam saw that it pleased he who is to bless Israel, he did not go as at other times to look for omens, but set his face toward the wilderness. Now, isn't this interesting? Balaam doesn't check in with God this time, because he really wants the cash. And this checking in with God is hindering that. And so I think he must have imagined that he could phrase things himself this time. But it don't work that way. Balaam lifted up his eyes, saw Israel camping tribe by tribe. So he sees the encampment down there that we've described before with the tabernacle at the center of it. And the Spirit of God came upon him anyway. So he gets possessed this time involuntarily by God's Spirit. This is an example of how God will use even rebellious people for his own purposes. And so he took up his discourse and he said, now remember, he didn't want to say this. He was trying not to say this, but God wants it said nonetheless. "The oracle of Balaam, son of Beor, the oracle of the man whose eye is opened." Now think about how he must have felt being out of possession of his own voice at this point. He's been turned into a puppet by God and forced to say these things in his own words. "The oracle of him who hears the words of God, who sees the vision of the Almighty falling down with his eyes uncovered." Now that is probably the description of his past interaction with God. That God spoke to him, that God showed him visions, and that he showed God proper respect for providing all that information. Remember, he's famous for being a very successful prophet of God. But that's all going to end very shortly here, because he's now a traitor. Verse 5, "How lovely are your tents, O Jacob, your encampments, O Israel." So he sees all of that encampment down below him, and he describes them in poetic form. "Like palm groves that stretch afar, like gardens beside a river, like aloes that he who is has planted, like cedar trees beside the water." the encampment was very well organized, remember. So it's got very straight lines of passing through paths and streets, north and south and east and west. And all the tents are very well organized. And so it does look like an organized garden down below him a few miles, you know, like 2 or 3 miles below. Water shall flow from his buckets, and his seed shall be in many waters. That's a description of Israel's future prosperity in the land. One of the ways that you planted in the ancient time was a field was flooded, and you threw the seed on the receding water area, and this is how it kind of got a jump start on its germination process. His king shall be higher than Agag, and his kingdom shall be exalted. Now, Agag here is probably a reference to the Amalekites, who are a very aggressive Canaanite group, and they're always looking to kind of take over other people groups and make them into slaves or steal their stuff. And it appears as if Agag is the name of its premier king and then becomes kind of a name that passes through time. We will hear and read and study about a king Agag in the time of David, a king Agag of the Amalekites, in the time of King Saul, and he'll end up being killed by the prophet Samuel. And then later, much later in the story of Esther, there will be Haman, who is an Agagite, a direct descendant of the kings of the Amalekites. So the Amalekite king Agag was apparently well known for being exceptionally powerful at this time. And the prophecy that Balaam is forced to give here is he is nothing compared to the king of Israel, as in God. Verse 8, God brings him out of Egypt and is for him like the horns of the wild ox. He shall eat up the nations, his adversaries, and shall break their bones in pieces and pierce them through with his arrows. So God is the one that brought Israel out of Egypt, and God is the one that's going to establish Israel in the land, and God is the one that will deal out justice against an awful lot of the Canaanite groups in the process of bringing Israel into the land. Verse 9, he crouched, he lay down like a lion, and like a lioness, who will rouse him up? So we're back to the metaphor of the king of the jungle. Blessed are those who bless you, and cursed are those who curse you. And that is a direct reference to the Abrahamic blessing, isn't it? Back in Genesis chapter 12, at the very beginning of Abraham's story. Now, verse 10 says, Balak's anger was kindled against Balaam, and he struck his hands together. You know, clap those hands, as in what you would do to a bad child, a person that's saying things that you want them to knock it off. And so Balak said to Balaam, I called you to curse my enemies, and behold, you have blessed them these 3 times. Therefore now flee to your own place. I said, I will certainly honor you, but he who is has held you back from honor. So he fires him. That's what it sounds like. He says, you just need to go home. I'm not paying you a thing. And you know why you're not getting paid? Is because you allowed this Yahweh to get in the way of your wealth. And Balaam said to Balak, did I not tell your messengers whom you sent to me, if Balak should give me his house full of silver and gold, I would not be able to go beyond the word of he who is to do either good or bad of my own will. What he who is speaks, that I will speak. Or what the he who is speaks, that will I not speak, basically. And now, behold, I'm going to my people. So yeah, I am going to take off here pretty soon. Come, I will let you know what this people will do to your people in the latter days. So now, God tells Balaam he's got one more message to deliver. And so this also is inspired. Even though the person being used to pass it on is not really a good guy anymore. He has moved over into the realm of enemy of God. So verse 15, he took up his discourse and said, "The oracle of Balaam the son of Beor, the oracle of the man whose eye is opened, the oracle of him who hears the words of God, knows the knowledge of the Most High, who sees the vision of the Almighty, falling down with his eyes uncovered." So this is all introductory, talking about Balaam's past positive relationship with the Creator God. God Most High, the God of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, the God of Abraham's relatives living up in Paddan Aram, the God of Israel, all the same God. He introduces what now becomes a very important messianic prophecy. "I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near." So he sees a personage in the distant future. And what does he say further about that person? "A star shall come out of Jacob," that is, out of Israel, "and a scepter shall rise out of Israel." Now, a scepter is a king's ruling rod, a ruling stick. And this, more than likely, is the passage that the Magi in the New Testament gospel story of the Magi coming to Jerusalem, it's probably the passage that they ran across when they were trying to find an explanation for the new star in the sky. And they saw this talk about a rising star and a rising scepter king in Israel. And that's probably what started them on their journey to the Holy Land, to Jerusalem, asking around, "Where is he that is born king of the Jews? For we have seen his star in the east and have come here searching for him." Now, the reason I believe that is because Daniel became, at a very young age, the leader of the Magi in his time period. And as such, he would have brought into the library of the Magi all of the books of Moses, all of the prophetic scrolls of the Israeli people, including his own scroll, the book of Daniel, which includes a timed prophecy, chapter 9, for the coming of the Messiah, which I'm sure that the Magi saw that as well. So here we have the reluctant, greedy prophet being used to pass on a messianic prophecy that gets used in the gospel story. But it's a double prophecy, because it's not just about Jesus, it's also about David. Because a scepter is also a stylized mace, that is, a handheld weapon that's used as a club against your enemies. And so it says, "It," referencing the scepter or the mace, the king's mace, "it shall crush the forehead of Moab and break down all the sons of Shet." And so here, Balaam is forced to tell the Moabite king, eventually a king from Israel is going to take Moab down. And not just Moab. He is going to take down other kingdoms of this region here. Verse 18, Edom shall be dispossessed. Seir, which is another name for Edom, also his enemies shall be dispossessed. Israel shall do valiantly, and one from Jacob shall exercise dominion and destroy the survivors of the city. And we know that King David brought Moab and Edom, as well as other kingdoms in the region of Israel, under his control. And he did it with some military force. And then we had just been talking about Agag earlier and the Amalekites. Verse 20, then he looked on Amalek and took up his discourse and said, Amalek was the first among the nations, but its end is utter destruction. Amalek will be destroyed over time because of Israeli action. We're running out of time, so we probably won't get through the fullness of this. Verse 21, he looked on the Kenite and took up his discourse and said. Now, the Kenites came out of Midian. They were actually Moses' in-laws. And some of them joined the Israelis on this foray toward the Promised Land. And they are Bedouins. And so the prophecy toward the Kenites is, enduring is your dwelling place, your nest is set in the rock. Nevertheless, Cain shall be burned when Asher takes you away captive. And so much later in Israeli history, the northern kingdom, where a lot of the Kenites lived, was going to be overrun by the Assyrians in fulfillment of this prophecy.